unknown vessel. This is Weyland Yutani, Anchor Point Station. Please respond.
Troop transport Sulaco. Return.
New?
The kid bit me!
Don't touch me!
Don't touch her!
Bishop.
Hicks.
Weapons Division intends to develop the alien.
Audible Studios present Alien 3 by William Gibson, starring Michael Biehn and Lance Henriksen.
Stay frosty.
You watch the movies, slap flicks, slap tracks for the good, slap bad, it's the slash film cast. For the girls, slap boys, slap old, slap young, yeah, we watch till the last of the credits is done.
Hello everyone and welcome to the Slash Filmcast, the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. I'm David Chen and with me is...
Jeff Cannata.
And Devinder Hardwar is not here this week. Unfortunately, he's at CES. Jeff, have you been to CES before?
Oh yes, I have definitely been to CES. And my heartfelt condolences are with Dave, who is... Or excuse me, not Dave, with Devinder, who is clearly not sleeping... Probably fried on having to run from giant hall to giant hall, seeing all kinds of tech, going to press conferences. It's a very difficult show to cover, and I'm sure he is burning the candle at both ends this whole week.
Mm. Our hearts are with him, and I'll be shocked if we ever see him again, Jeff, to be honest with you. But hopefully yeah, he makes it back, but we missed Devinder, and you can read all his coverage of CES at Engadget.com. He'll be back next week, hopefully. In Devinder's place, joining us today for not necessarily the first time, but the first time on an official episode, is my fiancé, who you may know is at Joy of Napping on Twitter. And for the duration of this episode, we shall refer to her as Joy, for short. How are you doing today, Joy?
I'm well. You know, to be clear, I'm not like the Joy from Blade Runner. I'm not like an AI.
Yeah.
I'm an actual, yeah.
You know what? It's actually really
human.
Really good that you mentioned that, because with Dave, you never know. And but I do have to point out that is exactly what an AI would say.
Mm. Indeed, indeed. Well, it's great to have Joy with us today, especially because today the movie we're going to be reviewing is I, Tonya, and Joy is literally the biggest fan of women's figure skating that I know in my entire life and has an encyclopedic knowledge of it. So she's the perfect guest for today's episode of the podcast. You can find more episodes of this show at slashfilmcast.com. You can also email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Today, we're just going to talk about the Golden Globes really quick and then dive into our review of I, Tonya. So I anticipate it'll be a shorter episode than usual. But before we get to that, last week on this podcast, we covered our top 10 films of the year. And sometimes in our enthusiasm, we may overlook some movies. And I wanted to call out this email from Vanessa H., who writes into slashfilmcast@gmail.com. It should perhaps go without saying that the last year and a half have been pretty rough for women. The ugliness exposed by the 2016 election will not soon be healed or forgotten. But in the midst of that darkness, there were some bright spots, many centering on the entertainment industry. The exposure of abuses committed by Harvey Weinstein and other top and lower tier entertainment figures, and the galvanizing hashtag MeToo movement brought sexual harassment victims and allies together, and many men, including you three, seemed earnestly to take up the question, how can we be better? This year also marked a few notable accomplishments for women in film. One, Wonder Woman was the highest grossing film of the summer, garnering over $400 million domestically. It made more than Captain America Civil War, Guardians of the Galaxy, or any of the Iron Man films. Two, Girls Trip, a comedy exclusively featuring women of color, cracked the top 10 summer box office and made well over $100 million. Three, Colossal, while not a wide release, provided a fantastic and empowering volley against the metaphoric and literal monster that is toxic masculinity. Four, Atomic Blonde gave us a convincing and non-exploitive exploitative female 007. Five, Lady Bird gave us a female coming-of-age story written and directed by a female director and is doing pretty well by pretty much every metric. These accomplishments fly in the face of so much of the rhetoric that has been used to sideline women in film, that a female superhero wouldn't be marketable, that minority women don't generate enough box office for studios to bother catering to them, that a serious female spy wouldn't be convincing, and that people just aren't interested in the experiences of women as told by women. My issue is not that you did not cram your top 10 list with these movies, but rather that, with the exception of Lady Bird, which did make each of your lists, people listening to your episode would not even know that these movies existed in 2017. Numbers 1 through 4 were not mentioned in your discussion of the movie year in review, nor were they discussed in any of your honorable mentions lists, nor in any context or capacity. This would be understandable if these were obscure films, but except for Girls Trip, these are all movies that you reviewed on the podcast. What's the deal? I thought this was a pretty significant year for women in film, but no one listening to your top 10 episode would get that message. Thanks for reading. End quote. That comes in from Vanessa H., writing into /filmcast@gmail.com. And that is a fair critique. We neglected to mention what an amazing year women in film had, and that is our bad, and we are copping to it and mentioning it now by reading this email and saying sorry about that.
I do think that it was a huge oversight that when we talked about trends of the year, we certainly talked about the Weinstein issue, which I think dominated the year as far as a trend, but a much more positive. Well, that is a kind of a positive thing in a sense that this kind of behavior is being outed now. But I think even more positive is the way this emailer frames things and showing some of the successes of female helmed, female starring, and female narrative movies of the year. I think she's right. You're right in bringing it up that we should have mentioned that and made that a bigger deal about that. I will point out that Lady Bird was on all of our lists, but we all loved that. And my number one movie is about a female butting up against the male patriarchy. So I would add Three Billboards to the list of movies that our emailer mentioned as one that I think is of the year in that theme.
Yeah, I think also the top – this has been pointed out a few times. The top three domestic grossing films of the year were Star Wars, The Last Jedi, Beauty and the Beast, and Wonder Woman, all of which are movies that have female leads, which is pretty remarkable. Like these movies did incredibly well.
If I could just add that, you know, I don't know if it was a particularly good year for women in film as opposed to other years, but I think it is a really nicely crafted message to put together this kind of case or this highlight reel so that we can think about the things that did go well and try to build from them for next year. I'm really looking forward to A Wrinkle in Time, directed by Ava DuVernay, the live-action Mulan, which I believe also has a female director. And as we're thinking back on 2017, the other piece I would add is Big Little Lies. Although it wasn't directed by a woman, it's based on a story written by a woman and then championed by two women, Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon. And then, of course, was a story about, you know, five or six women and the relationships between them, and I think really resonated with an awful lot of people as a result of the nuance and the texture that they brought. I really appreciate the email and would just add Big Little Lies as, even though it's not a movie, like part of this bigger story that we saw last night at the Golden Globes of celebrating broader kinds of storytelling.
Indeed.
Yeah, certainly my favorite TV show of the year as well, man. Big Little Lies, phenomenal limited series. And I'm so interested to see how the heck they're going to do a season two of that show. It's going to be interesting.
I mean, yeah, they definitely left the door open for a season two at the end of that show, but it will be interesting to see because most of season one revolved around a single event that was very...
A
single mystery, yeah. That's right, yeah. But, you know, that brings up a good point, which is something we didn't have a chance to talk about on last week's podcast, is other things that we saw that we really appreciated that weren't necessarily movies. And Jeff Cannata, you had brought up, like, Vietnam was something that you really appreciated, right?
Very much so. Yeah, it's incredible work and one that contextualizes that time period in a way I'd never seen. I mean, my parents lived through it, and obviously I haven't lived through it, but you hear about it because, you know, you're just one generation removed from that experience. But seeing it and having the way that miniseries dealt with both sides of the story, it's not just from an American perspective. It is also from the Vietnamese perspective. And you kind of see what is going on a macro level between the two countries, and starting so far back in time and building up and really seeing all of the events that conspired to create that quagmire. It's an amazing work, an amazing work.
The only other things I wanted to shout out, you know, were I didn't have a chance to mention Nathan For You, which is one of the things I was able to watch while I was on break from the podcast. And the season finale of Nathan For You in particular, possibly series finale of Nathan For You, I just thought was an extraordinary piece of work in its own right. It's called Finding Francis. Errol Morris wrote a lovely piece about it in the New York Times. You had a chance to watch Nathan For You, Jeff Cannata?
No, I haven't.
I would recommend it. I think it's something you'd appreciate. So.
Mm.
And yeah, I mean, I think those are just a couple of things. You know, I watched Black Mirror the entire season the day it came out. So that's technically in 2017, and we will talk about Black Mirror at some point in the future. But yeah, that was another thing that I really appreciated as well. I don't marathon or binge that many shows these days, but Black Mirror is definitely one of the ones that
did
I feel worth mentioning.
Did we get two seasons of Black Mirror in 2017, or was that 2016 that the last one?
I think, yeah, 2016 was the last one is yeah, my okay. recollection.
It was like around the same time, like end of the year 2016, right?
Yeah. I think that's right.
I love the idea that it's like an annual holiday tradition to like spend some time soaking in dystopia with your family.
Yeah, it was like fall of 2016.
You mean more than I'm normally soaking in dystopia with my family?
Exactly. All right, and I'm trying to think if there's anything else worth mentioning that was kind of like a big thing that was watched in 2017. But
I mean, I think Stranger Things is that thing for a lot of people.
Did you get into Stranger Things season 2, Jeff?
No, I didn't. I have not watched season 2. I don't know why I'm just not compelled, but I'm not.
It's just not something that like really resonates with us, I don't think. And by us, I mean everyone on the podcast right now. So a couple of other things I wanted to mention, a couple of Netflix shows I wanted to mention. American Vandal turned out to be much smarter than I gave her credit for after I watched the first 5 minutes and then gave up initially. And I just found it to be not only hilarious, but a very insightful look into the relationship between journalist and subject that I really appreciated. It's on Netflix. It's American Vandal. Jeff, have you seen any American Vandal yet?
I started the first episode and I was not drawn into it, but yeah, I understand that you have to kind of get over a hump with it.
Yeah. I think Joy was kind of in the same boat. She watched a few minutes and was just like, this is not for me, but yeah. I kept going and it was worth it. And I'm really excited for season 2. So that was another show. I watched the entire thing in 2 to 3 days. So really enjoyed that. And BoJack Horseman, the new season of BoJack Horseman.
So amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Great season of the show. And they continue to do new and interesting things with the characters. And so, just wanted to mention those other things as things that really made an impact on my year from a pop culture perspective. So, okay. So that's the top 10 episode. Now, before we get to our review today of I, Tonya, I wanted to just quickly mention the Golden Globes, which we all saw, at least in part. They happened this past Sunday. I think less or more than most awards ceremonies, it's really not worth getting too bent out of shape about who wins Golden Globes, because I just think they're not artistically a super interesting award ceremony, right? The awards are decided upon by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, which is a group of under 100 people with not necessarily the most compelling qualifications to determine what is the best picture or not. Compared to the Emmys or the Oscars, which are voted upon by peers that actually work in those fields. So I don't take the awards too seriously. But what is interesting about this ceremony, first of all, whoever does win the awards, it is used as a marketing piece of content. Like it's used as marketing content to say Golden Globe award winning blank. It kind of gives some movies a shot in the arm from a box office and marketing perspective. So that's interesting to consider. And also, of course, the ceremony itself, there stuff happens at the ceremony. Speeches are said, and there's crazy moments that occur, and they become part of pop culture on their own. So it's worth noting for those reasons.
Well, it's just the looser format. People are seated at round tables, and they're heavily liquored up. So
I think people are pretty liquored at the Oscars, too.
My understanding is things get a little bit wackier at the Golden Globes, but not having attended, I cannot vouch.
So, Joy, you watched pretty much the entire Golden Globe ceremony. Was there anything that you thought was particularly notable about this year's ceremony?
Yeah, I did. You know, I actually was not particularly interested in watching it prior to the ceremony, partly because, as you're saying, it's, you know, the tastes of the Golden Globe voters is a little bit all over the place, and it's not particularly predictive of the Oscars. However, I start seeing this sort of hashtag time's up and, you know, like that all the actresses are wearing black on my Twitter timeline. And I realize, oh, this is kind of like a thing. Maybe I should tune in and see how they address this really singular moment in the history of their industry. And I was really pleasantly surprised that it wasn't people simply mouthing a couple of platitudes throughout the night, but that it actually felt almost like a piece of programming that had its own emotional journey within it, absolutely, you know, punctuated by that thunderclap of a speech by Oprah Winfrey. But, you know, lots of people had lots of things to say. And I greatly enjoyed hearing from different folks. Honestly, I wish I had heard from more men about the topic during the night. Seth Meyers did some of that, but mostly it was women talking. And that's, there's no, nothing wrong with that, obviously. So I found it overall really refreshing.
Yeah, Jeff, were there any moments from the ceremony that really resonated with you?
Oh, many. It's hard to top Oprah's speech, as Joy
Which
mentioned.
Which brings me to this. What I know for sure is that speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. And I'm especially proud and inspired by all the women who have felt strong enough and empowered enough to speak up and share their personal stories. Each of us in this room are celebrated because of the stories that we tell. And this year, we became the story. But it's not just a story affecting the entertainment industry. It's one that transcends any culture, geography, race, religion, politics, or workplace. So I want tonight to express gratitude to all the women who have endured years of abuse and assault because they, like my mother, had children to feed and bills to pay and dreams to pursue.
Just an incredibly composed, incredibly delivered, incredibly eloquent thing to say. It is just a magic moment of really capturing what everyone wished they had the words to enunciate, and what the perfect voice to do it. I don't know. Obviously, we've gotten this fallout of sort of political overtones from it, but I'd rather.
I feel like we've lived five news cycles since the
every
Oprah speech happened.
Every day is five news cycles.
but first, there is the Oprah gave her speech. It brought down the house. It was an incredible speech. You know, it got dusty in the room, and then immediately there was the speculation that maybe she's going to run for president. And then there's all these people. Just speculating on whether that would be a good idea. Why would Oprah, you know, there's already like the backlash to Oprah being president. And then there's like the backlash to the backlash. All in the last 24 hours, I've experienced this on.
This is the world we live in now, Dave. This is how it happens. The backlashes come like waves crashing against the beach one after another. But I think all of that was established. I mean, Seth Meyer, who I think actually did a really excellent job. I loved his opening monologue. I thought it was fantastic in an impossible situation. You know, like he was great, but he also made the joke well before Oprah, you know, hours before Oprah took the stage, he made the joke about her running for president. So I think that was already sort of in the air. And then of course the speech itself felt so soaring, and you know, she has this wonderful Dawn of a New Day line that just feels like a political mantra or trademark line along the lines of "Yes, we can." So it has that feeling to it. So I can understand why people got that from it, but I prefer to just listen to the content and not sort of get swept up in the style and the horse race of potential, 2020 nonsense. And I think that does a disservice to really what she was saying, which is this really powerful thing.
I completely agree. I found the, Oprah for president sentiment to be honest, baffling, not because I don't think that she would necessarily be a good president or that she wouldn't make it for a good presidential candidate. Like, I think those are very much open questions that she plausibly has a case for. I mean, look at the world we live in where Donald Trump is the president. If Donald Trump can be president, then Oprah can be president, because I just have a suspicion that Oprah is a little bit more popular than Donald Trump right now. So I don't doubt her ability to become president or have a plausible shot at it. But I just felt like the actual message of the speech got completely erased in all the speculation afterwards, at least, in the stuff that I was reading and in my Twitter timeline. I really appreciated Dahlia Lithwick's article about this at Slate.com. She wrote an article headlined "Oprah's Real Message." It wasn't about her. It was about us. Quote, "I have no idea whether Winfrey plans to run for the Oval Office in 2020. According to reports, she's actively considering it. But I heard the force and dignity of her speech as a mirror held up to the country about our own responsibilities, accompanied by a very prominent shout-out to journalists for helping to tell those stories. This was a tribute to nameless women who have faced their own hashtag MeToo moments without receiving attention or justice, and for today's young black girls on linoleum floors who couldn't previously imagine themselves winning a Lifetime Achievement Award and woke up Monday thinking they just might," end quote. So I felt like it was this very inspirational speech about how the importance of telling stories and how seeing role models on the national stage can really motivate people to do great things. And that was my big takeaway from it. And I hope that people are able to watch that speech, like you said, Jeff, appreciate the content of it, without necessarily wondering about her political aspirations. But who knows? Maybe she will run for 2020 and I will be proven completely wrong and naive in my statements. Joy, what were you going to say?
I just fear that this podcast is at the risk of spending all its time talking about the presidential angle and not the actual content. And so I do want to say that I think she actually landed two messages really brilliantly. One is that we here in this room at the Golden Globes as entertainers and media figures have great responsibility in the sort of representation we put on the screen or into people's ears or in front of people's eyes or whatever. But the second piece was that you individually at home have a responsibility to tell your story. Your story is valuable. You could have a horrific thing happen to you like Recy Taylor did and be raped and left for dead. But she chose to tell her story and pursue justice, which never came. But because she worked with Rosa Parks, and Rosa Parks didn't give up on that case. Like, I think she is making that sort of long arc of history bends toward justice kind of argument, that you may not see any change in your own situation or maybe even in your lifetime. But the summation of all of those things is what is making the hashtag MeToo movement powerful. And so for me as an individual, I found it incredibly inspiring. And it, had nothing to do with whether Oprah is going to, whatever she's going to do with herself and political aspirations.
Yeah, I mean, I think the speech itself was inherently political in that it was encapsulating a moment in time that is political. And one of the big lines from the speech that I found to be gobsmacking was this notion of speaking your truth, right? It's not just tell your story, not just stories are important, but speak your truth, because that is the most potent thing you have in your arsenal. And I think that notion, regardless of whether Oprah is the vehicle to deliver it, or any, regardless of her political aspirations, that is a, I think, uniquely appropriate message for the moment in a time when fake, like if fake was the word that defined 2017, I'm hoping truth is the word that defines 18 and beyond, because it's an important notion that resonated very deeply with me, this idea of stand there, look them in the eye, and speak the truth. And I hope people took that away from the speech as well.
Well said, both of you. Before we move on, I also wanted to just call out the actual awards themselves. There were a few interesting events that occurred. First of all, three billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri won big. Best drama, Frances McDormand won for best actress.
Very well deserved, I would say.
She did a great job, yeah, in that film.
Unbelievable. And I got a lot of messages, I must say, from Flash Film listeners who thought I was vindicated. I would just say that, Dave.
Okay. Well,
vindicated by the Hollywood
Foreign Press. Hollywood Foreign Press Association.
It's something you
always want to hear. The most august organization ever. The same organization that nominated Burlesque and The Tourist for Best Picture.
Hey, there are dozens of them, Dave. Dozens.
There are literally dozens of Hollywood Foreign Press people.
I'll take vindication wherever I can get it, Dave.
We still need to have a big fight about that movie, Jeff. I'm not looking forward to it. But yeah, three billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri. Problematic. Anyway, what else happened? Lady Bird won big. Best motion picture, musical, or comedy. And
Saoirse Ronan.
Best actress,
yeah, for Saoirse Ronan. So wanted to call that out as well. And it led to another really big and oft talked about moment in the evening, which is when Natalie Portman introduced the Best Director category.
And here are the all-male nominees. For The Shape of Water, Guillermo del Toro.
That provoked a lot of reaction, much of it positive, I think, because, you know, she's calling out the fact that there is only males nominated in this category. Shortly after that, Barbara Streisand took the stage and mentioned how she's the only female to have won the Best Director Golden Globe in the Golden Globes history. I thought Scott Beggs on Twitter put this really well. He said, quote, "Backlash against Natalie Portman's scalpel-esque dig at the Globes is a classic macro/micro problem. Macro, the system gives us all male nominees. Micro, but did these nominees deserve to be put on the spot? Answer has to be yes, if the macro is ever going to be fixed." So anyway, that's Scott Beggs on Twitter talking about this issue. Yeah, I think he highlights the issue well, which is that maybe these directors didn't necessarily need to be put on the spot, but at the same time, if we don't call it out, it will continue to be a systemic issue. Joy, what was your reaction to that moment, just out of curiosity?
For me, it was actually one of 20 moments in the night, I think, in which either people made scripted jokes or unscripted jokes about pay inequity between men and women or casting decisions. One of the most shocking things I saw in the night actually was on the red carpet. Earlier, Deborah Messing was being interviewed by Juliana Rancic, I think, from E! News.
And I'm here to celebrate the rollout of this incredible initiative, Time's Up. You know, time is up. And we want diversity. We want intersectional gender parity. We want equal pay. And I mean, you know, I was so shocked to hear that E! Doesn't believe in paying their female co-host the same as their male co-host. I mean, I miss Kat Sadler. And so we stand with her. And that's something that can change tomorrow. You know, we want people to start having this conversation that women are just as valuable as men.
Really put her on the spot. And I thought, you know what? This is slightly different than other award shows. You know, like this really is feeling like a different night when people have sort of had it up to here. And when Oprah yells to everyone in the room, time's up, like it really feels like a clarion call and not just like a slogan. And so, you know, I don't know that Natalie Portman's moments specifically stood out to me more than those others, but the sort of accumulation of all of those together felt very powerful.
Yeah. Emily Nussbaum actually also commented on the Natalie Portman moment. She said, quote, on Twitter, "The wild thing about Portman's gesture was the fabulous brass of it. By inserting those words into the award intro rather than into a winner's speech, she guaranteed that the next five shots would be the nominees' faces." I know the night's not over, but for me, Portman's was the climactic moment. Different from a red carpet statement or even one of the great speeches, a challenge to the etiquette of the whole occasion. End quote. So I think that's a pretty, you know, valid take on it, that it does kind of upend the decorum in a lot of ways. And I thought that was interesting to observe. So
can I ask you a question, Joy? This may be a tangent we do not want to go down, but I'm curious what your take is. Do you think there should be a best male director and best female director category? And if not, do you think there should be just best acting performance category?
I do think there should be just best acting performance.
So there would be fewer nominees in total, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And I think part of the reason so that's maybe a problem that if we solved it would create other problems. And I get that there are trade-offs and perhaps really undesirable ones. But I think in an ideal world, yes. And I think right now the percentage of films directed by women is something on the order of 7%.
Right.
So not only is it very low, you can imagine it skews super low budget and toward a certain kind of film that doesn't get as wide of a release as might get talked about on a podcast like this or, you know, broader attention.
Well, yeah, I mean, Greta Gerwig was not even nominated, even though Lady Bird won for Best Picture, so for comedy or musical. So,
do you not think, and I'm just throwing this out there as a possibility, do you not think having a Best Female Director category might actually help that problem?
Yeah, so I think that's the trade-off, right? It's like a probably incredible way to improve representation because the marketing that comes with, you know, having a best yada yada director or, you know, these kinds of awards is really powerful. On the other hand, it implies that the skill set is somehow different, which has always troubled me about the actor versus actress piece. And it's really noticeable that a lot of the best actress nominees are like wives of main characters. Like they were the biggest actress, but they weren't actually like a leading, like the leading protagonist in the film. There's also sort of an artificial distinction between the lead and the supporting, right? And there's a lot of gamesmanship that goes on with that. So I agree with what you're saying that it would solve certain things. But to me, that could only be a stepping stone.
Well, I'm looking at, I'm just having the discussion. I'm not trying to convince you or me either way. I don't know how I feel about it. But I'm looking here at the best performance by an actress in a motion picture. I have not seen All the Money in the World, but I've seen all the other films. Frances McDormand, Sally Hawkins in Shape of Water, Meryl Streep in The Post, Jessica Chastain. None of them are just the wife in those performances. I would have to guess that if there was just a best performance in a film category, one or more of them would drop off the list in favor of, you know, a mixed bag of men and women. I agree with you that there is no distinction. I think Frances McDormand gives the best performance of any human being in this calendar year or really any other calendar year. So clearly I would vote for her above any gendered human. But I think there is a case to be made. I understand that I'm sort of arguing for this weird segregationist perspective, which is not where I stand. But if the purpose of these awards or any award is to sort of surface greatness and shine the light of attention on deserved artistic, you know, performances or endeavors, wouldn't it be better to have more total nominees and actually know that you're going to get five women directors surfaced and you know, front facing to an audience?
Well, I actually think the strange thing is that the acting is the only gendered category. So we're not talking about best screenplay written by a woman.
Right.
And so I think that my assumption is that because these things are very heavily tied in with marketing, you know, the stars are the faces of the movies and they help sell the tickets. And so it's more important to have more representation or broader categories. And that's why we have not just an actor and actress, but a supporting actor and a supporting actress. And sometimes we even have ensemble awards. And so I assume that that is sort of driven partly by marketing from or lobbying from the studios of what kinds of things they want to see rewarded and how.
I think it's an interesting thing to consider. I don't think there's an easy answer to it. I'm very interested in your take and other takes. I think it's clearly a problem and one that doesn't have an easy answer. If you're dealing with five total directors from what is it, 10 films? I mean, there's two film categories. It's not gendered films, but it is genred films, and I don't know why there's only those get whittled down to an even smaller subset. It just seems problematic in and of itself from that perspective too.
Well, I think you're right, Jeff. We could keep talking about this for a while, and it's not just a problem that Golden Globes needs to solve. Oscars
sure.
and many other award ceremonies need to consider how they're going to proceed along these paths as well. Wanted to mention one final moment that really stuck with me from the night, which was the moment when James Franco won for Best Actor.
I've been thinking about that. I feel very badly about this.
What do you mean? In what sense?
Well, I don't. You go ahead. I don't mean to cut you off.
So, a lot of people have been pointing to James Franco's troubled sexual history, which obviously is something that is a problem given the tenor of the evening. But what was weird was he invited Tommy Wiseau up to stage, and Greg Sestero was there. And for those who don't know, James Franco starred in this movie called The Disaster Artist, which is about the making of a movie called The Room, widely regarded as one of the worst films of all time. The Room was directed and stars, Tommy Wiseau, and also a man named Greg Sestero, who wrote a book about it called The Disaster Artist. That's the book that the movie was based off of. So James Franco and Dave Franco played Tommy Wiseau and Greg Sestero. I don't know how you pronounce his name, so I'm just trying a bunch of different ones. And they all four of them went to the ceremony. And then James Franco won for Best Actor. And he invited Tommy Wiseau up to stage, and Tommy Wiseau tried to grab the microphone and talk, and James Franco pushed him back. And I think he wanted to let him talk, but there just wasn't enough time. Greg Sestero sat there in his chair looking at the stage, and it just seemed like the most kind of bizarre, somewhat tragic moment that I've seen at one of these ceremonies in quite a while. Like this idea that these guys, all they wanted to do was make it big in Hollywood, and when Hollywood told them no, they said to themselves, we're going to make our own movie. They made their own movie. It was regarded as terrible. But then these other guys, James Franco and Dave Franco, made a movie about the making of that terrible film, and they're winning all this acclaim because of it. It just felt to me like, man, I bet Greg, probably has dreamed of him, himself being on that stage. It must have just been a crazy moment. But Joy, what were you going to say? It sounded like this, you thought it was weird. And
I thought it was just a really douchey move to swat Tommy Wiseau, physically block him from
right,
the mic.
Well, on the one hand, I have actually interviewed Tommy Wiseau, and once he gets in front of a microphone, he can be quite unpredictable. So I think it's a solid move from a presentation standpoint. But you're right in that
that's
James
punching way down. It is not a good look for James Franco. And then add to that the fact that he is hashtag problematic in terms of his personal history. I think there might be a story coming out about that. That he imitated Tommy Wiseau's accent in his acceptance speech. It was like, this person over here is just an object. And I am, not only robbed these other guys of agency, but it was a really ugly look, I thought.
Yeah, it was bad, especially because James Franco wouldn't be up there were it not for Tommy Wiseau, right? I always find it weird when people go up and they don't thank the people who they're based off. Although we should mention that there was very mixed reaction to Allison Janney praising Tonya Harding in the room as well as online, and we'll talk a little bit about that. People seem to be trying to recast Tonya Harding in a different way now that this movie's out, possibly for marketing purposes. And I don't know that the internet's really taking it well. So looking forward to talking about that. But anyway, that's the Golden Globes. Anything else you guys want to mention about the evening? I thought it was a overall pretty eventful ceremony and well worth conversation. So,
yeah, for sure.
All right. Before we get to our review of I, Tonya, I want to shout out all the people that donated to the podcast this week. I want to thank Katarina Koltliar, I think, who asks us to please watch the movie Faces Places. I've heard Faces Places is very good. BJ Thomas, Michael Crowder, Christina Tobin, thank you so much for your donations to the podcast. Thanks also to new subscribers at the rate of $2 per month, Todd Baker, Celeste Benavides, Samuel George Mitchell, and Leanne Royo. Thanks so much for donating to the show. If you want to contribute to the podcast, go to slashfilm.com, click on the SlashFilmcast tab, use the PayPal links on the side of the page. You can also go to paypal.me/filmcast. That's paypal.me/filmcast. And all the money you donate goes to helping us defray the cost of seeing movies and putting on this podcast for you. So thanks so much for your donations. Let's get to our review of I, Tonya.
4.8.
How do I get a fair shot here?
We also judge on presentation.
We're going to need to even the playing field. I know a guy. Shouldn't even be saying his name. Derek.
The press wanted me to be the pile of crap. I never did this.
What is going on?
We're with the FBI.
They know something.
What can you tell us about Tonya Harding?
I don't know a Tony Harding.
Aren't you her bodyguard?
That was from the trailer for I, Tonya, the newest film by director Craig Gillespie. It was written by Stephen Rogers. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. Competitive ice skater Tonya Harding rises amongst the ranks at the U.S. Figure Skating Championships, but her future in the activity is thrown into doubt when her ex-husband intervenes. Really, really That's underselling what the ex-husband's
God
involved
awful with. Awful description. My God.
So, I mean, I think that the broad
it's like,
strokes.
Like saying the OJ, it's like OJ Simpson's going about his life when strange occurrences get in the way.
Then like, he kicks a rye.
Yeah.
I think that the overall events of I, Tonya are well known, but we will still divide this review into a non-spoiler and spoiler section. And Joy, you are one of the biggest figure skating nuts that I know. You really enjoy this sport. And
I'm
you follow
the only one, though, to be fair. It is a sport with a fading fandom.
Mm. Well, I want to dig into that a little bit. You guys obviously know each other well. I don't, and I assume our audience doesn't as well. I want to know the roots of that before we even delve into the movie. How did you become a fan of figure skating? Did you figure skate yourself? Where did that come from?
Yeah, I'm tragically bad on the ice myself. I think that it actually mirrors what has happened nationally with figure skating, which is I had some interest in it. Then the Tonya and Nancy thing happened and it was ubiquitous and unescapable. And I became a huge fan immediately after that.
So this is even more about the events of this movie. It's not just that you're a fan of figure skating, but these events actually.
Yes, I remember these events extremely well. I have like VHS tapes that are like worn down from me watching them over and over because this was the start of my real obsession with skating. And right after this whole thing happens, Tonya and Nancy get sent to the Olympics. And I think everybody knows that. But the first alternate is this young woman named Michelle Kwan, who's only 13 at the time, who becomes this huge star and perhaps the best skater ever. And I followed her career super intensely. And, you know, skating remained very popular in America pretty much as long as Michelle Kwan was skating. And since her retirement, it's been sort of on a steady decline. I think there was a pretty large judging scandal at the Salt Lake City Olympics regarding pairs figure skating that you guys may or may not remember that I think was really also challenging to the credibility of the sport. And so,
yes, I remember it well, the great pairs figure skating fiasco of 19, whatever. No, I'm just joking.
Lies.
I don't know.
Lies.
Anything about
I had
it.
To. I had to show it to you on YouTube. But at this point, the sport is in decline in a number of ways. You know, like the competitions get held in smaller venues, the ratings are down, the sponsorships are starting to get sort of embarrassingly small. And so it's an interesting time for us to be looking back at this.
Right, because it used to be that if you were a gold medal figure skater, you know, Toyota or Coca-Cola or whatever would sponsor you, or you know, would, yeah, would sponsor you. You'd be in TV ads. You'd be rich just based off that. That's no longer really the case. Most people can't name a famous figure skater from the last few years, right?
I think what I'm saying is that in America, it has particularly declined. That is actually still true in some other countries like Japan and South Korea. But, you know, sports that are niche sports need stars. Tennis needs Serena Williams. And so...
I'm the only one that remembers the Beatles.
Hello, I'm Guy Garvey. Richard Curtis and Danny Boyle have joined forces for Yesterday. We got them together to talk filmmaking.
I always saw Trainspotting just as the Northern Four Weddings.
Music.
These songs were part of us.
And a world without the Beatles.
A world without the Beatles would be infinitely worse.
The Yesterday podcast, available from wherever you get your podcasts.
Yesterday. When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?
We don't have that level of star really anywhere in the world for skating that kind of captures a broader audience than the folks who are the diehards.
Yeah, I was just hearing today on NPR this, I guess, this Japanese male figure skater is, they
Yuzuru
say
Yuzuru Hanyu?
Yeah, he's like as big as LeBron James in Japan. He's like a massive star.
He is incredible. He is really transcendent. But I would say, like, you'd be challenged to find people who are not hardcore skating fans in America who know that name, right?
Yeah, right. No, yeah, for sure.
So, Joy, since this was your lead-in into skating obsession, what did you think overall of the film?
You know, it was in some ways hard for me to set aside my geeking out over tiny, amazing accuracies they had. Like, they even nailed, like, what Tonya Harding's practice outfits look like from, like, these soft focus, you know, features they would have about her on ABC Sports or whatever. So I was really, like, fangirling over that stuff. But totally trying to set that aside, I actually think the movie is very good. Allison Janney, in her Golden Globes acceptance speech for Best Supporting Actress for this movie, talked about how everybody has a different truth. And so that kind of goes to the theme of the night that we talked about earlier about speaking your truth and telling your story. This is a story told from many perspectives, and it is laid out clearly from the beginning that there's not going to be one truth. But I think that was probably the only way to tell a story that was quite as crazy as this. And I think it really worked. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, what do you do when you have a story where the truth is only known by two to four people, and all of those people are giving you a vastly different account of events? That is just very difficult to reconstruct, right?
We've heard the term unreliable narrator, but this is like a group of unreliable narrators.
Right. Right. And so it's very difficult to reconcile those narratives, and this movie does it by many different techniques. You know, it assembles its own version of the truth, but it also breaks the fourth wall. It shows flashbacks and has characters commenting on how truthful they might be. So it tries a lot of different things to tell this story. I think, yeah, definitely the subjective nature of truth is one big message of it. Another message is this idea of classism, right, within the skating ranks. This idea that Tonya Harding was not what these figure skating judges wanted to elevate as the standard bearer of their sport. And because she came from a more challenging background than people like Nancy Kerrigan, that she was punished for that because her style was different than other. I think, you know, I was watching Nanette Burstein's movie, The Price of Gold, which actually Stephen Rogers, the screenwriter of this movie, was inspired to write this movie after watching that movie, or that was one of his inspirations or one of his pieces of research.
And The Price of Gold is a documentary.
Yeah, documentary, 30 for 30 documentary. And it was, I think the phrase was kind of like the girl next door with a hint of glamour, I think was what the saying was of what people were looking for in a figure skating champion. Like that was the ideal vision of that, and Tonya Harding did not live up to that, and that might have propelled some of her actions. But Jeff Cannata, what were your overall thoughts on this film?
I came into it completely uninterested in the subject matter. As much as I admire the pure athleticism of figure skating. And I certainly, during Winter Olympic years, can get caught up in watching some of it here and there. I'm not particularly interested as Joy is, or even more than that, more than figure skating as a sport, this particular time period I have memory of living through, and it just felt like a tabloidy kind of trashy movie of the week topic that just didn't, I didn't know the details, but I had a vague recollection of living through all of it, and it wasn't something I was interested in, which is to say how amazed I was that I came out of this movie completely riveted and enjoying it and enraptured by all the details. And I think that is because the movie is so stylistically strong, and all of those things we've talked about in regard to how the narrative is presented, the sort of speed and alacrity of how we move through these worlds. And the movie is very slick. It feels like a Coen Brothers movie.
Yes, I thought that too.
And I love that. It like gets inside the locality of these people and the sort of these very odd characters that are real people. They're real characters. I mean, Allison Janney's amazing, and I think deserves the Golden Globe that she won last night. But I also loved, the other various idiots that we meet in this movie. Paul Walter Hauser is amazing as Sean. I mean, he's amazing and so fun and funny, and just the sort of the twists and turns, the minutia of this, best laid plan by morons. It's very much, what's that movie? A Perfect Plan. What's
a
that
Simple
movie?
Plan.
A Simple Plan.
Sam Raimi's film. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so
I feel
good.
Like this movie has the tone and machinations of a Coen Brothers movie with the stylishness of a Martin Scorsese film. You know, like
yes,
in terms
very
of how
much. It's very Goodfellas-y.
Yeah. In terms of the soundtrack and the camera movement, it's very much like a Goodfellas or a Wolf of Wall Street or something, a Casino, you know, something like that.
One of the triumphs of this movie, I think, is how the actual ice skating itself is shot.
Completely.
I'm not a huge fan of the head replacement that they did. I thought it was competent, but pretty, I could see it was rough around the edges for me.
Yeah.
But I think if you actually shot Olympic figure skating this way, you couldn't, obviously, but if you could, man, I think it would be so much better the way the camera swoops in and you clearly have someone on the ice with the skater, going in and out and around them in almost a dance in and of itself. I just thought it would have been very easy to direct those sequences to look like how you see figure skating on television. And I thought it was brilliant that that's not what the movie does, that the movie presents it in a much more dynamic, cinematic way that totally worked. And I found myself going, man, I wish actual figure skating was shot like this.
Yeah, Joy, as a figure skating connoisseur, how did you feel about the style of the skating sections?
Well, there are two things that Jeff's comment provokes for me. The first is that I really admired that choice as well, to have the camera not only on the ice but moving around, and lots of focus on her face at the center of the frame, because normally what we're used to on television is that the camera is far away looking down and you are judging this little person who's running around trying to land these really difficult jumps on this 1/8-inch blade of steel. And so by putting the camera down there, you are witnessing like the athleticism. You are hearing her panting and breathing because it's so difficult of an exertion for her. And you're really feeling from her point of view what it must feel like to know that these giant, jumps are coming up. The second thing that this is a little bit of skating nerddom, but the triple axel that she lands and that they talk about at length in the movie is so difficult that very few women to this day, 26 years later, have landed it. And so they could not find a female figure skater who could actually land the triple axel, who they could body double. And wow. So they had to do all kinds of editing tricks to get around it. They basically use either double axels or they cut away. But I think that's just a testament to how incredible Tonya Harding's achievement really was.
Huh. That is impressive. Wow.
Yeah, I thought the skating sections were amazing. And what's interesting, I mean, they did not make it easy on themselves. Do you know what I mean? Like, he could have shot it, Craig Gillespie could have shot it in such a way that made it easy to cut around, but it almost felt like the way he was shooting was designed to make it as thrilling and as challenging to shoot as possible. Like you said, Jeff, there are some scenes from the CG and the head replacement or however they did it, but they could have used a lot more cuts, and they didn't. A lot of these skating sequences take place in one long continuous shot, and it's incredible to watch. So, but yeah, I think every performance in this movie is fantastic. There's been a lot of commentary about this movie being very condescending to its subjects, you know, mocking the people whom these actors are portraying. I did not feel that way. You know, I did not feel that they was mocking them. I felt like it portrayed them as fairly complex people who, for one reason or another, were trapped in the situations that they had found themselves in, right? And whether it's by their own doing or some other cause, I found it to be a sympathetic portrait. Joy, what did you think? Did you feel like the movie was condescending towards Tonya Harding and Jeff Galooly?
I think maybe not. Maybe it's a little condescending to Sean, but that's going to be a tough one. If you go back and watch
actual footage,
to the news,
yeah, it's very similar.
They're pretty much verbatim, and he's an odd duck, to put it nicely. He's a man who, for instance, continued to claim that he was like part of an international spy agency after this all occurred.
Yeah, we're talking about Sean Eckhart, who was Tonya Harding's bodyguard in real life.
In fact, he was not her bodyguard, as far as I can tell. I mean, at least she said he was not her bodyguard, and I can tell you, I've covered many figure skating events myself. I have been backstage. There are no other skaters with bodyguards, no matter how famous they are. So it was an odd choice to start off with. If anything, you know, to be honest, I think it was a little bit gentle on Tonya Harding. I think the goal is to make her not completely sympathetic, but at least relatable. And so I think there could have been quite a lot more done that would have made her look clownish that they cut out.
Yeah, I think the movie certainly takes the position that she is innocent of any wrongdoing, which I'm not sure is historically clear.
I think it's ambiguous on the question of whether she, had a role. Like,
the movie is?
I think the movie is a little bit. I mean,
really? I think it's pretty clear that the movie thinks that she thinks they're dumb and wish they had been involved.
You know, I think you're right about that. There, in the trailer and, you know, in the movie itself, she does say something along the lines of, you know, who would ever have a hit put out on their friend? That's insane. Who would ever do that? And it reads as kind of mildly sarcastic to me. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like that. But you're right. Like, when you're watching the movie retell the events, it seems pretty clear that the movie's belief is that she was not involved.
Right. Which I don't think is absolutely historically clear.
I've seen the sentiment a few places online that this movie, I, Tonya, gives Tonya Harding the Marcia Clark treatment. That is to say, Marcia Clark basically was rehabilitated by movies like The People or shows like People vs. O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story. A character that was held up for ridicule by the American people was now getting her due. And certainly Tonya Harding falls into the first half of that category, where she was ridiculed by the American people. She was made a punchline relentlessly over the course of many months. But unlike Marcia Clark, Tonya Harding did not fight to put a murderer in jail. Tonya Harding was involved tangentially with this situation where another figure skater was assaulted. And that's something else people have brought up, is that Nancy Kerrigan is almost completely absent from this film. You know,
right.
The victim is almost completely absent. And Joy, I was curious, like, what did you think of that decision to basically exclude Kerrigan's story from this movie?
Well, firstly, I actually think I disagree with you guys about whether this movie takes the point of view that she's completely innocent. If it's completely innocent versus completely guilty, I feel like it's innocent-ish, but leaves the door open with the pieces that you could make a case that she's guilty if you wanted to. Because I think that's partly the thread they're trying to portray with the fact that she's surrounded by people who are so violent. Nancy Kerrigan choice did not bother me at all. I understand what people are saying, but it is actually not a true crime story. Although it sort of gets into heist territory towards the end, or that feeling of a heist film. For me, what this is like, can you understand why Tonya Harding is the person she is, including that she may or may not have participated in this, either lightly or known about it and failed to prevent it or been all the way up to the mastermind? And I think the movie leaves room for all of that.
So I think what you're saying is it wasn't like the movie is trying to do one thing. It wasn't trying to tell the whole story of Nancy Kerrigan and all that. And so because it was trying to do this one very specific thing, you're cool with Nancy Kerrigan not being a part of the story. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not called I, Tonya, She, Nancy.
Exactly.
Indeed. So it sounds like
at one point early in the movie, Tonya Harding's character, played by Margot Robbie, says, "Nancy gets hit one time and the whole world shits. For me, it's an all the time occurrence." And I feel like that's the point, is that for her, like, she's completely desensitized to this on some level, to the point of callousness.
Hmm. And I think that is the movie building a defense for her in a large sense. And and I don't have a problem with that. I just think it's hard to read this film as anything but making her a sympathetic character that was not a party to that kind of madness. I think it's a more interesting film just sort of being from her point of view and not being swept up in that moment. Like, the movie is about more than that moment. I think that stuff is a relatively small percentage of the stuff we see. And I think for me, the far more interesting bits were her relationship with her mother and how she grew up and the love story and the shocking violence that you see throughout her life, all that stuff I found to be really compelling. And I think that's one of the reasons I liked the movie more than I expected to, because it didn't just focus on this sort of tabloid story. It really gave a larger, more interesting picture that I wasn't aware of.
So, Jeff, how did you react to the violence? Because one criticism I've seen of this movie that I don't personally share is that that sort of lighter Scorsese-like tone that's so stylish and the dark comedy kind of undercut the viciousness of the violence. Did you find that to be true?
I did not. No, I found the violence to be really harrowing and rough. And yeah, there is a sort of a stepping out a couple of moments with the characters are like, I didn't do this, or, you know, as it's happening. But I didn't feel like that stole from how it's presented is very jarring and very brutal. And, you know, you get a very deep sense that this is a woman that went through some horrific things. And I didn't think that stole it from it at all. For me, it really, I felt like the movie, I was impressed with how the movie didn't pull its punches. These were characters that looked like they were just brutalizing each other. And, that affected me as a viewer.
Yeah, I think there's been I've seen some talk about how this movie in some ways minimizes domestic violence, and I did not feel that way at all. I felt like it depicts domestic violence as a really tragic cycle from which it's difficult for women to extricate themselves. What did you think of the film's depiction of domestic violence, Joy?
Yeah, you know, I rewatched particularly with an eye toward this because I am sensitive to that. Question mark, you know, being raised. And it's true that, like, the first time she gets hit by Jeff Galuli, I mean, I don't think that's a spoiler, right? That in real life they had domestic violence issues. she turns to the camera, breaks the fourth wall, and says, you know, he hit me a lot, and starts sort of, and that is a big tone shift. But there is a climactic, or not a climactic, but probably the worst incidence of domestic violence happens a little bit later. And there's no music. There's no breaking of the fourth wall. It feels a lot more like the camera is objectively in the room. And perhaps you guys remember the moment that I'm talking about. And my heart just broke for her. And it was awful and devastating to think that someone you love and trust and whose approval you want so badly could hurt you so casually. And then it cuts to her mother saying, you know, like, oh, this wasn't a big deal. Oh, please. You know, and so you do get the sense, for me, at least my experience of the movie was I really got the horror of it. And then I got that someone thinks that's not a big deal. And that's like an important piece of the story is people's attitudes towards it. Mm. And that doesn't mean that the filmmakers agree with that lightness of attitude.
The thing that movie, I think, does really, really well, and you almost never see in films, is this sense that this was an everyday thing for her. This was just part of her life. So often in movies, even movies that deal with this kind of thing, it feels like this climactic moment or a couple of big outbursts that you see dramatically depicted on screen. And in I, Tonya, you really get the sense that she's just going about her life, getting the crap kicked out of her day in and day out. And that to me is even more heartbreaking and heart-wrenching because, I mean, there are all these scenes of her like just putting on makeup to cover up her bruises today and going about her day. It's like, it becomes so pedestrian that it's almost more horrific.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that's the baseline that's laid.
Right.
Yeah. I agree. I thought the way that the film treated it, it feels casual. Like it felt casual in the sense that it wanted you to understand that it was casual and that that is horrifying, you know, not like right. The film is treating it casually.
Right.
But that the violence itself was casual.
You can get used to anything. And yeah. These people did. And that's just unbelievable.
I think the other thing, though, about the violence is you can see these are incredibly strong personalities at play. And you can see why they are drawn to each other like magnets and then pushed apart as if the magnets, you know, poles were reversed. And like they're constantly kind of wanting things from each other that are impossible. And it creates this real pressure cooker of a situation that ultimately, for extremely ill-advised reasons, explodes into this sort of national story. But even prior to that was just constant chaos between all of them.
All right. Well, all that said, it sounds like we all really enjoyed the movie. I put it as my number two movie of 2017, and Jeff and Joy really liked it as well. But we have a few more things to say about it in spoilers, so why don't we get to spoilers for I, Tonya starting right now.
Now you're looking for the secret.
You're going to see this coming.
No.
But you won't find it because, of course...
You're not going to see this coming.
You're not really looking.
I have been puzzling over how it works.
You don't really want to work it out.
Who's in the box?
I have been dying to tell you.
I want to tell you my secret.
You want to be fooled.
The only moment I want to highlight from the end of this movie is the moment between Allison Janney's character, who plays Tonya Harding's mom, and Tonya Harding at the end with the tape recorder.
Yeah, I practically want to cry just thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very tragic moment, and it's also like an ambiguous moment, I think, because I think a lot of people interpret it as that Allison Janney's character is lying to get the piece of tape that she's looking for. But in fact, I listened to an interview with the writer, and the way that they played it, or the way that she was trying to play it, was the idea that she was telling the truth, that there was another side to Tonya Harding's mom, where like she actually appreciated and rooted for her daughter on some level. And that was one of the biggest conflicts of the movie that I found to be really compelling, was this idea of this mom being this kind of toxic figure who nonetheless was able to motivate her child to do great things. I mean, I think that's reminds me of other movies that bring this dynamic up, like, for example, Whiplash, the Damien Chazelle movie, where you have a teacher who is extremely emotionally and sometimes physically abusive, and does so under the guise of wanting to bring out greatness from their student. And both movies kind of leave open the question, is it worth it?
It's a big theme of Molly's Game as well this year.
Yeah, I don't think they necessarily come to a conclusion on that question. I don't think, like, when I guess Tanya comes to more of a conclusion about it, because it's hard to look at this and think to yourself, well, it was a good thing that Allison Janney treated Tanya Harding's character that way, you know. But on the other hand, if Tanya Harding's mom had not been so challenging, like, would Tanya Harding have achieved that level of greatness? It's not a clear answer to me. You know, like, the answer to that question is not clear.
There's an old Mr. Show sketch that I love. It's very dark, but the idea is there's this service that parents can go to that will teach them how to abuse their kids in just the right ways to turn them into great artists or achievers in different ways, you know. And it's played for laughs, but I think the themes are basically the same. Is, you know, these monsters that get results because they are so demanding and so punishing to their kids. Do the ends justify the means? I think from the perspective of Allison Janney's character, absolutely. Like, she thinks she gave, as she says explicitly, "I gave you the best gift I could have given you."
Right.
I hardened you. You know.
Yeah. Joy, what do you think of the notion that that there needs to be some level of emotional abuse or emotional stress to become as great as some of these people are? Like, do you feel like, yeah, it is essential that that's part of your training? Or do you feel like it should never be part of training, that people can still be great without that?
You know, I don't know that I'm sufficiently expert to weigh in on motivational techniques and parenting, since I'm not a parent, but I will say that I actually think Allison Janney's character is quite a bit more complicated than just, "I'm going to shame you into being better." It's lightly mentioned, but Tanya Harding is like the fourth or fifth of her children, and she gets married 5 or 6 times in total. And yet, with no resources at all, she is still driving her to practice. She is still taking her somewhere in the sport where the chances that you succeed are basically statistically zero, no matter how talented you are.
I actually wish we had seen more of that. I was really sad that they was kind of glossed over. Like, why is this horrible woman even doing this? What, like, I think her childhood, I would have liked actually a little more time spent there to understand how this even became a thing.
Yeah, the dynamic is very single faceted, it feels like. When you compare, you know, to another movie this year, Lady Bird, that features a much richer portrait of a mother's relationship with her daughter, this feels often like a self-parody almost, in terms of how one-sided at least that relationship was, not necessarily that character. But, Joe, go ahead.
Well, it's just a testament, I think, partly to Allison Janney's performance, that she is just so riveting to watch. And all she does is monstrous stuff. And yet she's the person I want to watch the most of and want to spend 2 hours with afterwards. That she has this sort of charisma, that she bullies her way, essentially, on behalf of her child, bullies their way into Tanya getting skating lessons at such a young age. And like, that has to be a form of care, right? And so you could see that Tanya on some level knows that she's very heavily invested in, and that is a form of love, but she's never going to get a kind word, a warm gesture, the other forms of love that like all children need. And so you can see why she's still wanting it so badly from her mother throughout the movie, and tries to replace that with the abusive love she gets from Jeff Galooly, and why that would feel like an upgrade to her, to feel desired and to be told outright that she's pretty when, you know, her mother only has harsh words for her. So I don't know. I actually felt that her mother... is it possible to love someone and also to be a monster? I think it is possible. And I really appreciated the portrayal for showing that.
Let's talk a little bit about verisimilitude. Joy, earlier you brought up that there were some things in the movie that you felt really excited about, that they got correct. Anything else in the movie
that
you mentioned?
I'm happy to like rattle through several of them, but Jeff, for you, you came to this as a lay viewer, and I could see all the effort that they put in to nail even these tiny details, but to you, did it have the ring of truth despite this kind of lighter and occasionally even campier tone?
I have to admit the movie felt a little cartoonish at times. And I think a lot of that has to do with we spend a fair amount of time with our lead characters when they are in their teens, and they are still played by people that are clearly in their late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah.
And the things they do to make them teenagery are fine. They're fine. But I think it places the movie into a little exaggerated place for me.
It reminded me of Walk Hard, to be honest. Dewey Cox.
The parody.
The parody where John C. Reilly plays the high school version of himself. Because that's what they do often in these biopics, is they have this. Like, I almost thought it was a joke, but it ends up being a significant part of the film. Like, I thought it would be like they flash back to it for maybe one scene, but it was, you know, no. Right. Margot Robbie's playing 15-year-old Tonya Harding for a significant part of time. So,
and that's fine. And I think it actually marries really well with this sort of stylized presentation of everything, with the long takes and the you know, breaking the fourth wall and all of that stuff that is having fun with narrative. Like, I'm in it for that. I'm having a great time. But it didn't make me feel like, oh man, this is, you know, documentary level authenticity of this moment. But I did, I will say the other side of that coin is that I really did enjoy finding out all these crazy details that I never bothered to know, even as I was living through it, because I wasn't particularly interested in it. But like all of the details of how everything went down and who was doing what and where and all that stuff, I found to be much more interestingly presented than I thought was possible. So, you know, I liked the level of minutiae and detail there that was present. It didn't occur to me that it was like, oh man, this is all super authentic, because it felt so stylized.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that to me is almost shocking about the movie, is you really would not believe that this is possible. Yeah. You wouldn't believe that somebody would move his car every 15 minutes. I think in reality it was 30, but like in a parking lot to avoid being observed. Like, how stupid can this person possibly be? And yet that actually did happen. You wouldn't believe he could run through a window of plate glass or a door of glass on his way trying to escape. But he did also, in fact, do that.
Well, especially because he had like this baton that he could have used to hit the glass, for instance. You know, like there's little weird details like that. But yeah, what were some of the biggest details that stuck out to you, Joy?
Well, number one, almost everything she wears is like a shockingly accurate replica of things she actually wore. So maybe they say it's the 1991 competition and she wore it in 1992, but like these are slavishly recreated. And this is true for her rather famous on ice skating outfits, but also for the stuff she's wearing when she's like walking around the neighborhood or what her hairstyles look like. As she gets a little bit better results, she starts having some kind of designer accessories and they put those in. And I felt like it was really telling the story of it is in some ways, I admit, a slightly tacky sport and a little bit about what you know, the image you're trying to project and sort of her awkward attempts as someone who isn't from that world to fit in, I think what really came through. She did really skate to ZZ Top, although not in the way that they show it. You know, I think they do a really good job of recreating that problem she had at the Olympics. So I don't know if that's something you guys might remember, but she has a problem with her skate lace at the Olympics after Nancy Kerrigan.
Right. When we watched this, you had mentioned that this was a woman where drama seemed to follow her, right? That no one had ever had a problem like that before, or it was extremely, extremely rare.
Yes. Right? So this is where the verisimilitude for me is like a little bit lacking. Prior to this incident, Tonya Harding was known as a person who had just an insane slew of problems, none of which were ever her fault. And so they do have one of these that they mention in the movie where it's like, oh, she fails on a triple axel. And she's like, well, my skate blade wasn't mounted well. And see, that wasn't my fault. And so you do get the sense that she's a defensive and evasive person. But that did, in fact, happen. But then prior to that, she had another issue where, like, her dress came partly unhooked during nationals. There was another time that she was skating and, like, her skate blade wasn't, you know, firmly attached. And she stops in the middle, goes off to the side and says, like, can I get a screwdriver in the middle of her performance, and reaffixes the screw to her own boot and then keeps skating, does quite badly in the end. And so it was like really unsurprising that, oh, she was the person that needed a do-over. She's the one that needed an exception. In all my time watching skating, I don't think I have ever seen one incident like this with any other skater. And it just always,
let alone like multiple for one skater, right?
Yeah. And, you know, like they show her firing her coach and then the coach and her reuniting. Well, in fact, she fired her coach, then she went back to her, and then she fired her coach again. And then she, like, it was all within like 2 or 3 years at the height of her performance. She had this really terrible attitude of entitlement that made her really difficult. And people didn't hold her rags to riches story against her. If anything, in my view, they were rooting for her. And so it is, all of that, I think, gets kind of smoothed over quite a bit.
Yeah, the film does get at that a little bit. But I, you know, in the instance of her and the skate breaking down, your sympathy is with her. You know, the movie makes it out like, oh, this woman who's in the situation that she can't help, poor Tonya Harding, right?
Yeah, but how many times can lightning strike one person?
Right, exactly. So either she's I think the movie seems to posit she's just extremely unlucky, right? That seems to be what the movie's positing. And I think what you're saying as an observer of this sport is it beggars belief that someone could be that unlucky in real life.
Right, because of a lot of stuff that doesn't even make it into the movie. But another place I think they show her not taking full responsibility is that she has asthma and she smokes.
Yeah.
See, this is why I think the movie is squarely in her court. And to mix my sports metaphors, it's squarely on her side. I think maybe your knowledge of her as a person gives you a deeper reservoir of information through which to watch the movie. But
it may color my perception.
I think it may because what I got from it is a purely sympathetic telling of Tonya Harding's sad tale of being, you know, in the wrong place at the wrong time with the wrong people who always mistreated her. And she's culpable for sort of, you know, being around them. But it really does seem like it is her sympathetic to her plight, I think, from the entire film.
I think there are hints of what Joy is talking about in the interview segments that the movie cuts between, right? That you see interviews with like a recreated interview with modern day Tonya Harding, where she consistently denies culpability for anything that happens to her. So you kind of get a taste of it, but you're right.
Yeah, Jeff. I think you're right.
But I think you're right. That overall the movie makes it out like Tonya Harding was the unfortunate recipient of this, you know, she got dealt a bad hand, and you know, right, that's what the movie's about. So it's I think if there's one thing to take away from this spoiler section for I, Tonya that you're listening to right now, it's complicated.
I mean, I think the movie is basically, what I got from it, Joy, was that the movie said, like, this underdog who finally got herself into this position because she tried to get out of this relationship, and this guy was such a nutball. He did this stupid thing, and she was right about to be in this place where she could finally beat the girl who'd been, you know, trouncing her and all these things. She was at the top of her game. She was finally coming back. And if it wasn't for this idiot boyfriend who did this crazy thing, she may, you know, that's how I feel like the movie frames that situation. But I don't know if that's accurate.
Yeah. How accurate do you feel that is? I agree with you that that's how the movie frames it. And Joy, how accurate do you think that is?
Wow. I think you're right that I can't divorce my knowledge of the facts, which is that she had a season where she landed several triple axels and it was amazing. And then she started to go downhill from there. So it wasn't that she wasn't relevant or that she didn't have a shot. She skated badly at the Olympics. I think she ended up eighth. She had been written off a little bit as a little past her prime. And so, And in skating, that can happen in 1 year or 2 years because it's such a sport for, you know, little baby ballerinas. But, you know, I don't think that you're right that this may be being her last gasp. There was an air of desperation about her whole quasi comeback that year to me that maybe doesn't quite come through in this. But to me, you know, I think she does come across as tough, but brittle and funny and plain spoken and just like a woman you feel like you know from other parts of your life. And you can kind of see how her environment, you know, would have set her up to be capable of these monstrous things, but that she herself still seems like a child at heart, I think is kind of how it, like almost an arrested development thing, is how it played to me in the movie.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, those are some more facts on the Tonya Harding situation. And watch the movie, watch the documentary. There's actually a bunch of YouTube content. Some person went back and assembled like all the footage of the entire story from news clips on YouTube, which I've found very instructive. So I'd recommend that. It's like,
isn't it amazing that in that time we had like hard copy, and there's like a reporter from hard copy that's interviewed for this film. And, you know, just seeing that title, which doesn't exist anymore, I guess hard copy as a show, just brought me back to that 90s OJ Simpson, just the advent of tabloids. And before we had reality TV, like this was our advent of reality television.
Yeah.
And it just anchored me in such a, I mean, this thing is a period piece, right? So
yeah.
I think it is also an interesting reflection on how fame and celebrity and that ravenous desire for a certain kind of very simplified story can really ruin people's lives overnight. And not to say that that isn't true today.
It is.
But it has a different sort of tenor today, too.
Well, I think one thing that's different today is just the life cycle is so much shorter today, in my opinion. Yeah. I just think the Tonya Harding, Nancy Kerrigan thing was many, many, many months. You know, it went on night after night of Letterman and Leno like ridiculing this person. And I just don't feel like the half-life is as long today. I feel like that whole story would be done in 1 week tops, and we'd have moved on to something else. But that's just my opinion.
For sure. I agree with you guys, but I also feel like Bobby Cannavale, who's in this, it's just weird that they even have this character in this movie. Like, I appreciate what you're saying, Joy, and I agree that it's crazy to be, like, set in this time period and remember how journalism was working at that time. But also, it's just a bizarre thing to just have this character there for the interview segments, but you never see him in the movie. I don't know. Just
yeah, it's almost like they were trying to create it like a they were trying to make it like seem like a documentary, right?
Yeah, but he's the only character like that, and it's just strange. Like, why do we care about this dude's input?
Right.
I don't know. It was odd.
Right. Right. It felt like maybe
he's the stand-in for all those like reporters who are on their lawns after the
event.
Yeah,
for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think you're right. The film's reach maybe exceeded its grasp a little bit with regards to that character and the point they're trying to make there. I mean, I thought the point was made, you know, beautifully in the film itself. You don't need the interviews of that guy.
Right.
But, anyway, that's our review of I, Tonya. Find more episodes of this podcast and more reviews at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Our spoiler bumper comes from filmmaker Kyle Hillinger. Our theme song comes from adamwarrock.com. Stay tuned to hear what we'll be reviewing next week. In the meantime, Jeff Cannata, where can I find more of your work on the internet this week?
Oh, you can always follow me on Twitter at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. I have several other shows, including video game shows. If you're into video games, I have a long-form show called DLC that you can find at 5by5.tv/DLC. I have a daily quick update video game show. So if you want to get your news about video games in a easily digestible format, check out Newest, Latest, Best. It's on iTunes and anywhere you find podcasts. Or you can find it at anchor.fm/NLB. And I also do We Have Concerns, which is a comedy science show. You can find it at wehaveconcerns.com.
If you enjoyed Joy of Napping's work on this podcast today, find her at Joy of Napping on Twitter. You can also find me on Twitter at Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chen, S-K-Y, and DaveChen.net. Next week.
And we didn't argue once about The Last Jedi. Not once.
It's awesome. It's amazing. you just gave people reason to hate this episode, Jeff. But next week, we'll be talking about Black Mirror Season 4. Black Mirror Season 4 will be diving in depth with spoilers into every single episode. So if you want to listen to next week's episode, watch Black Mirror Season 4 on Netflix right now. So much to discuss about
Black
Mirror.
Six episodes. You can do it. Six episodes. That's not too much to ask.
Yeah. And I think it's worth getting through them. I definitely. Overall enjoyed the season. Jeff, did you watch them all already?
I have two more to go, but I'm very much – I love Black Mirror, and I am very much enjoying it this season as well.
All right. Thanks for listening to the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. We'll see you next week.
The only one that remembers the Beatles.
Hello, I'm Guy Garvey. Richard Curtis and Danny Boyle have joined forces for Yesterday. We got them together to talk filmmaking.
I always saw Trainspotting just as the Northern Four Weddings.
Music.
These songs were part of us.
And a world without the Beatles.
A world without the Beatles would be infinitely worse.
The Yesterday podcast, available from wherever you get your podcasts.
Yesterday. When did you write that?
I didn't write it. Paul McCartney wrote it. The Beatles.
Who?